Remaker's Mark, Episode 49, Double Indemnity. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Remaker's Mark. Here we are in part two of episode 49, where we are discussing the film noir Double Indemnity. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing? And what would be a terrible way to fake a death in your mind?
I am fantastic, and I would say throwing a birthday party.
Do tell. Say more.
Well, it's hard
no,
to
don't.
Be. I won't, then. I won't.
Well, I'm intrigued. I don't understand. Keep going.
Well, it's you wouldn't throw a birthday party for someone who's dead, Kyle.
Interesting. You would be alive.
You would be alive. It's a birthday party.
Okay. Okay. I got it.
It's not an anniversary of someone's death. It is a, hey, Kyle, I'm having a birthday party. Come to it. You wouldn't say, well, but Andy, you're dead.
Okay, I get you now. All right, gotcha. I was thinking way too hard. I was thinking, like, is it like you have everybody over and then you discover that you're dead, but you're not actually dead, like that kind of thing? But
you went way too deep on that one.
All right, fair enough. All right, surface level.
You've known me too long for that, Kyle.
Fair enough. Jeremy Nilsson, how are you this fine evening? And how about you? What would be a really ineffective way to fake one's death?
I'm getting better and better as the night goes on, and I think hand delivering a suicide note.
Interesting. That's true and a terrible, terrible idea.
Yeah.
Like your own suicide note?
Yeah, like, or maybe hand-delivering a fake newspaper clipping of your death.
Right, or obituary.
Okay. Yeah.
The key to this, and again, we're overthinking again, is you're hand-delivering it.
Okay. I like it.
So it's got to be your death.
What a great question. Right. This is
it is indeed. Moving along, Lee, hop off a slow moving train. How are you tonight, and what about you? What would be a terrible way to fake your death?
I'm good, and I think making all of the funeral plans in advance, making all the funeral plans and then taking out $1 million life insurance policy right beforehand.
Interesting. Okay. Sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
Curious. My name is Kyle Delahunt. Mark Josting is still out sick. It's not as though this was 2 weeks later. We do record both of these at once. Movie magic. What? He is still sick, so he will not be with us. Mark, hope you are feeling well still. So I would say a terrible way of faking a death is thinking that you're going to get a very life-size, life-like dummy for like a big fall or a drop or something like that, and being unable to do so, and instead stealing a mannequin from like an Ann Taylor or something like that, and using that where it just flies completely stiff and then just shatters into hundreds of pieces upon falling down, where it's very obvious that it was a mannequin, not at all a human.
Because, hey, free dummy.
Free dummy, yes. Wow, deep cut. Very nice.
That's right.
All right, so good picks, everybody. Good choices. We can pretty much wrap up the episode now. I think that's all the entertainment we're ever going to need. JK, we're moving on. Before we go more into Double Indemnity, I have a Remaker's Mark recommendation for you. Last time I picked a podcast, and boy howdy, this time I am also going to pick a podcast, as mentioned. The podcast is called Dungeons and Daddies. It is not a BDSM podcast, as it notes in its title, although it's getting dangerously close to doing so from time to time. But it's basically a D&D role-playing game where it's four dads of different ilk. You've got like a sports dad, a former cover band lead guitarist dad, a granola dad, and a emotionally stunted and detached stepdad who end up traveling into an alternate sort of role-playing-esque universe to try to find, and they lose their kids, and so they have to try to find their kids. It's amazingly funny. If you're a D&D fan, you'll love it. If you're not a D&D fan, honestly, if you've ever like been D&D adjacent or just think that you like good storytelling that is funny as all hell, I'd say give it a try. Even if you're not like super role-playing person, it is so incredibly funny. The role-playing mechanics in it are very subtle, I would guess, like almost hidden, like it's mostly storytelling. It's not a lot of
it's almost inferred.
Yeah, it's not a lot of roll for initiative. Like it's really it's very storytelling. Yeah, so it is so incredibly funny. I am just dying every time I listen to it. It's one of those podcasts that immediately that it comes out, I listen to it as fast as I can. And that's the biggest compliment I can give to any show. So yeah, Dungeons and Daddies.
Also, if you're a fan of dad jokes.
Oh, yes, man. Yes. Dad jokes are like currency in this. And in fact, I won't say it. You'll see. But it's, yeah, it has an effect in the game, and it is glorious. All right, so let's now touch on Double Indemnity a bit. From a recasting perspective, in the first part, we recast 3 major characters and 5 minor characters. So let's go over our big winners for those. For the major characters in the role of Barton Keyes, originally played admirably by Edward G. Robinson, we went with Lee's choice of Liam Neeson. Good choice. Very good. Well done,
Yay.
Lee.
Yes.
Well done. The role of Felix Dietrichson, originally played by Barbara Stanwyck, we went with Jer's choice of Scarlett Johansson, all smolder Scarlett. Yeah. Well done. Good job. Very good choice.
Did you call her Felix?
I don't know. Maybe.
It was almost a lisp, like a Phyllis.
It sounds more evil like that way.
I'm kind of saliva-y tonight, I guess.
Felix Dietrichson.
Felix Dietrichson by Barbara Stanwyck. No, I didn't mean to, but if I did, great. Sorry. So the role of Walter Neff, originally played by Fred McMurray, we went with Lee's choice of Sebastian Stan, which I am a huge fan of. Good choice. Well done, Lee. Congratulations. Very good. And then for the minor characters, we went with Mark's choice. Mark in absentia is a big winner here from the minor side of things. In the role of Mr. Jackson, originally played by Porter Hall, we went with his choice of J.K. Simmons. So, Mark, well done. Sorry you couldn't be here, but you still represented. Good job. So normally what we would do in this point is we would talk about our next film and we would go alphabetically. But in case you didn't notice at the top of the episode, we mentioned episode 49. Now, the way that we count episodes here is a little bit different. This isn't like number 50 coming up. We actually have had like 130 something episodes in total with special episodes and etc. But you know what? 50 episodes of our kind of stand recording style is, I think that's admirable, and we're going to do something a little bit special for that. So for our 50th episode, we are going to sort of do a revisionist history, travel back in time a little bit. When we first came together as a crew of sort of talking about this podcast and deciding how we wanted to do it, what it would look like, one of the things that I had heard in recommending how to proceed with the podcast is to try to do as many practice ones as you can. And so we did we did an alpha and a beta episode, if you will, of Remaker's Mark. The movies that we chose, the beta was Mystery Men, and the alpha, the first one that we ever recorded as a crew, was Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which was just a fantastic movie with John Candy and Steve Martin, and a wonderful ensemble cast around it. It was a really good episode, and it kind of proved that, boy, this is actually going to be something really cool and really successful. It was not a failure by any means, which I was very happy about. So what we are going to do is we're not going to republish that one. Maybe we'll publish it on the side. It's actually hidden somewhere on mathishard.net. with a login and password. So if you find it, good on you. But what we're going to do is we are going to redo Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So we are, for our 50th episode, going to do Planes, Trains, and Automobiles again. And I'm going to propose that we don't listen to that. I was thinking about it, but I really think we shouldn't do it. Let's start fresh. And then maybe we can, a hidden adventure afterwards, is maybe we can compare our previous picks to our updated picks and see how they change from there. I think that would be kind of fun. So 50 episodes is a big deal. Again, even if it's not as round a number as the total number of episodes might think, I'm really excited about that. And I'm really happy that we've made it this far. And I think that's a cool way to celebrate it. So Lee's next choice will wait until after Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So we'll announce that then. So Lee, thanks for letting us kind of jump in here. But yeah, congrats guys on 50 episodes coming up. And I think there's no better way to do it than celebrating a damn good movie that we've already done.
I think it's very apropos that we are celebrating 50 by remaking an episode.
Yeah, exactly. It's how ding dang meta can you get?
I don't remember anybody's picks from that episode.
No, I can't either.
And I am excited to. I'm almost more excited to compare our picks.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a three-parter, like the usual part one and part two. And then I think part three, we should listen back and see what we did and who we picked and everything and go from there. I think that'd be really cool.
We have been doing these podcast for 6 years now.
Yeah.
Like published episodes.
Six and a half.
So yeah, that episode could be 7 years old.
Yeah, wow. Totally.
Which I feel like we've done remakes of movies more recent than that.
Too true. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that. And you should be seeing that in a few weeks after this comes out. So, yeah, should be a good time. So now let's keep back on Double Indemnity. We put a call out to Twitter and Facebook. And by we, I mean Jer did. Good job, Jer. Well done. I did not. And Jer, why don't you mention a little bit of feedback that you got from the casting standpoint of this film?
Yeah, I got two very solid bits of feedback. One from Jody Kajawa, and I know that I am mispronouncing his last name. He is a connection up in Duluth, and I think he has his own podcast, but I could be wrong on that. But anyway, he is a big movie buff up there, and he suggested Joaquin Phoenix and Lily James in the leads, and this is the killer part, John C. Reilly as Barton Keyes.
Oh, man.
Oh, do I love that.
Yeah, that's top notch. I strongly considered Lily James. I didn't think about Joaquin, but that's, yeah, those are all really good.
And then secondly, Allison Moffitt said, and she had to think several hours on this, and she got back to me, and she said Kristen Ritter in the Barbara Stanwyck role. Michael Keaton could be interesting in the Edward G. Robinson role, which is the Barton Keyes role. And then she said, but damn, John C. Reilly is flawless, which I think, and based on our noises, I think we agree on that one. And then she said, I can't quite cast Walter Neff, maybe Adam Scott, Chris Pine, Chiwetel Ejiofor. I'm sure you guys will nail it. So thanks.
I really like Kristen Ritter in the Barbara Stanwyck role.
That's edgy. I like that for sure.
So yeah, solid feedback. And also, Allison, thank you for the vote of support that we would have some good picks.
Indeed. I hope we don't let her down. That's formerly Allison Clotter, right? Clotter is her maiden name, right?
That is correct.
Yeah, so she's given feedback many times. Yes. Allison, thanks for continuing to chime in and being a hearty fan and participant in this. It's very much appreciated. And Jody as well. Thank you for chiming in. All right. So with that done, now we're going to talk about the plot, tech, and filmmaking changes, appreciations, maybe some slight modifications that we would do to Double Indemnity if we were to do it in a remake. Now, we talked a little bit in the first part about, do we make this as a 40s movie? Do we make it today? Do we just completely abandon film noir? But before we kind of dive into that, let's talk a little bit about just film noir as a whole. You know, Jer, I think you and I really, you know, mentioned a lot about how the vibe of this style of movie spoke to us. Do you mind starting that discussion about what you like about it, what this movie spoke to you in that regard?
Yeah, I am a fan of the genre of film noir, and it has been so parodied over the years, and it almost is it's not a punchline, but it almost has become sort of silly. And so going back to a movie like Double Indemnity, which a lot of people say is sort of what really solidified it as a genre and was sort of the textbook for future film noir films to come out, to go back and watch this and see just, man, how tight it is and how just really solid it is as that style of movie was really refreshing. And I just, I love... So, and we've already kind of touched on some of these, but I love it as from a cinematography standpoint and a filmmaking standpoint with how they use light and shadows, and everything feels so minimalist. And then you have this dialogue that's just a runaway freight train, but in the best way. And you have just this cadence and this dialogue that people don't talk like that. Everything is a simile or a metaphor, and just they are layered on top of each other. And it's one of those things that you either buy into or you don't. And I do, just hook, line, and sinker. I'm into it. And I think that it is it's something that you need a special hand both in writing and in directing to really knock it out of the park. And then you need actors and actresses that can buy into it as well. And I think that when we talked about our picks, I think a lot of us were reflecting on that as to whom we picked, minus Andy, who was making a different movie. And I would love to hear his feedback in this whole film noir discussion as well. But yeah, it's so good. And you have to just sort of let it wash over you. And watching this makes me reminiscent of more current movies like Quentin Tarantino movies that have the same sort of like just dialogue upon dialogue upon dialogue. And like, it's so unnatural, but it just fits and feels right. And then I'm sure we'll talk a lot with the movie Brick coming up later, but yeah, that's my opening statement.
Yeah, I think I agree with you completely. I mean, the vibe of it is just so interesting to me, and it's not something that I romanticize exactly. You know what I mean? Like if you were to say what makes a film noir, like part of it is kind of misogyny, like nope, don't romanticize that. Part of it is sort of violence and, you know, mistreatment of humans as a whole. Like, I don't really romanticize that. But somehow all those pieces together, like in the time that it was as a piece of a whole, it's just so compelling to me. Maybe it's just because it is so reflective of that time and place that it's not even like, you can't even say that it's like a more innocent time or something like that. You know what I mean? Because that's the entire polar opposite of film noir. It is not a more innocent time. It's a more evil time and a darker time and a more sinister time. But in spite of all that, I just find it so interesting. And I thought Double Indemnity, you know, speaks to that in a huge, huge way. I think that basically everything that makes film noir what it is, which I think if you were to summarize what makes a film noir movie. It is very darkly filmed overall, a lot of night shots, a lot of interesting use of very minimal lighting, like you mentioned. So like maybe one light bulb in a scene. Sometimes you'll see that, like you'll hear a breaking of a light and there'll just be one sort of swinging around lighting a scene. Specific lighting, so lighting across someone's eyes specifically. And then that style of dialogue that you spoke of that. So, I mean, I feel like this had four of those biggies. It was interesting in researching, you know, more film noir movies. Exactly, you know, how much that sort of started out as this tight type of film noir and then how much it expanded from there. You know, I mean, I feel like it started out as this genre that was those exact things like Maltese Falcon, which we've done here, The Third Man, right? So you get kind of those sort of, you know, very familiar ones that were noir-y. And then you get into things like Chinatown, you know, a little bit later in the 70s, that is very much that same style. And then you get something where it is someone taking a genre like film noir and then expanding upon it and using that as the start of it and then building that into a tremendous movie like something like Touch of Evil by Orson Welles. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but that is like an incredible movie. And it's a film noir at its heart, but it is just, from a filmmaking standpoint, unstoppable. It's absolutely incredible. So yeah, I it's almost a hard genre to defend other than the fact that so many people love it that I think I'm okay liking it. How about you, Lee or Andy? I know Andy, you had a hard time with this movie in particular. Do you feel like it was the noir aspect of it that you didn't like, or was it this particular cast of characters? What was it that didn't stick for you? And then Lee as well.
As I watched this, I realized I do not like film noir.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Jerry said, I think you either love it or you hate it. I just don't like how it tastes. To me, this seemed like a really interesting story that was coated in this flavor of goo that I did not like and I couldn't get past. And if you could scrape all that nasty stuff off of it, and then I think you'd have a very interesting story to work with. That's my perspective on it. So I was bored watching this movie, which I was bummed about because I was really looking forward to watching it because I've heard so much about how great it is, things like that. And really the only character that held my interest at all was Barton Keyes. I really liked Barton Keyes. I thought he was fantastic. I thought the actor was Edward Robinson was fantastic. But the other ones, the dialogue that was there because of the directing or the style and that pacing, all I perceived was kind of the affectation of their voices, and not, there just wasn't, it was all just one note just throughout the whole thing for me. And I really wanted some variants there. You guys have talked about like Quentin Tarantino movies. We've referenced that a couple times, and I agree there is, you know, that's dialogue aplenty. But I think if you watch Tarantino films, there's a lot of emotional variance in those. And for me, that keeps me much more interested. This one, it just seemed kind of just straightforward. Honestly, as soon as, like, in the opening scene where he stumbles into his office and he starts recording into that weird, like, Victorian era microphone. But, like, just the way he starts talking to me seemed really, it's silly almost. And I couldn't get past it. I will, however, call out my own hypocrisy by saying, like, movies that, any sort of, you know, fantasy, sci-fi, whatever movie that has a weird style of dialogue, I'm totally in. Like, it doesn't bother me at all. You know, I get that. I can check my own privilege here, but I just didn't like how this one hit me.
Yeah, that's fair. It is exactly how you mentioned that you have to buy in, and if you don't, it's a goner. Yeah, I agree completely. That was why my Bill Hader choice was so unsure for me. Like, I thought he could do it, but I was like, ah, crap, this is just going to turn into a sketch. So yeah,
I mean, and again, I think it has a lot to do with writing and directing. And then I feel like you can have a noir feel. Like, I don't mind, like, you know, the weird lighting and the very dramatic lighting and, you know, the trench coats and top hats not top hats, but you know what I'm talking about. The style of it. You can have that style of it, the visual aspects of it, because I find that very interesting. I think it's the dialogue. That's what's just hit me in the wrong spot. So I think if you can get the same story with a little more of a natural dialogue, for me, would make it much, much more interesting. But Jer might not like that movie.
They can coexist. That's okay.
And I think movies like that have been made, and sort of the natural evolution of where film noir has gone into more recent noir-esque movies, where they look the same, but they feel different. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that either.
Agreed.
I think the dialogue is hard to get past in this. But I mean, I do like the movie overall. I like the way it's shot. I like the story itself. It's an interesting story. But just thinking about some of the scenes that Edward G. Robinson was in, he seemed very natural. Like, everything that he was saying felt natural.
Yes.
Like, you know, he just was the character. Whereas everybody around him felt like they were reading it off of a script.
Yeah.
Yes, I would agree with that, Lee.
So that's the issue that I had with it. But overall, I like the movie. I would watch it again.
I feel like you could rewind to our Violet and Daisy discussion about, you know, sort of movies that have been inspired by Quentin Tarantino versus Quentin Tarantino movies. And one of the things that I mentioned is it felt like the characters weren't fully fleshed out in a way where it felt like they were reading the lines, not living the lines. I mean, I feel like this is something, a discussion of which continues in so many ways today. So yeah, I think that's spot on.
And I think that movie, now that we have watched this one, I think that movie could really be put into that sort of film noir type of genre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like quirky.
Yeah, it didn't occur to me then, but now having gotten sort of immersed in the genre a little bit more, looking back on it, it's like, yeah, that had a lot of very film noir type shots and dialogue and flow.
Yeah, totally. So, Andy, you alluded to it a little bit, but there's something that kind of came up in our pre-production that we wanted to touch on a bit, which is the voiceover aspect of this. So the movie starts with basically Fred McMurray making his way up to an office. We don't know whose office yet. We don't quite know all of the details. He sort of slumped over, but you don't see anything until he actually gets to the office, where you can see that he's bleeding out of one shoulder, and he grabs this dictaphone thing. Like, that thing's got to either have a hell of a battery or a hell of a tape in it, because it seems like he's dictating for like 6 hours. I don't know.
I have no idea. I have to admit, as soon as he started, I was like, that poor transcriptionist is going to have a hell of a time putting that thing on paper.
He says baby so much. Yeah, so I liked the voiceover. I don't know if I would have it again. But, you know, it sounds like, Lee, you had some other opinions on it. You weren't as big of a fan and for sure wouldn't want it in a remake.
No, I mean, I understand that, you know, for the time, it was probably really appropriate. But, you know, in 1944, it probably wasn't as common, and it was kind of like a new and different thing. And then I think, you know, as the decades went on, other people kept doing that, and to the point where film classes started saying, don't ever put voiceover dialogue in your script, because that is a lazy tool of a weak writer. That's what I was told when I was in college, that you should never do that. But yeah, it kind of dates the movie a bit, but it also works as a nice way of moving the story along, you know, in, I guess, chunks of time that would just be too long to show on screen. You know, you can sum a lot of that up with voiceover, which is, you know, useful in a story that takes place over a long period of time.
Yeah, I think I was okay with it because it was all just part of that mood. You know what I mean? Like, it's that same kind of thing where if you buy into that. But I don't know that it ultimately serves the movie super well. So, yeah, I think I'd be okay with it not being there. I do agree that it is probably the lazy choice, but somehow, you know, even amongst all that, I was okay with it in the original.
I think for me, it is such an ingrained part of what film noir is, and maybe that is a byproduct of the fact that the genre has been so spoofed since then, that's what I'm thinking of in my head. But it would be difficult for me to have that gone and still feel film noir-y. But again, maybe that is because of the fact that it is has been so lampooned and spoofed, and that is sort of the thing when somebody is like, let's make something that looks like film noir or feels like film noir, that they immediately come in with some sort of overdubbed narrator that is just overly describing everything with all of these huge flowery similes and metaphors, and describing every little, you know, piece of clothing that the person's wearing, or what the air smells and feels like, and all that, you know, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, maybe it is totally just filler and stuffing, but to me, it feels film noir-y to do it.
I would say that, you know, there are exceptions to that. Like, there are movies that, well, really great movies, that use voiceover. And, you know, I do think it helps the story rather than hurts it. I can think of three right offhand: The Shawshank Redemption, Goodfellas, and Fight Club, that are all, in my opinion, really great movies, and they rely pretty heavily on the voiceover. So it's not always bad.
Yeah, good call. Did Maltese Falcon, so we did Maltese Falcon, I don't recall which episode, but we'll link to it in the show notes. Did that have a narrator? Do you remember if that had a voiceover? I don't think so.
Man, now I don't remember at all.
I don't remember. I remember not liking it that much.
Yeah, I feel like that one was, I soured on that one too.
We didn't really come across that one very, we didn't give it too high a rating, I think.
That was a For Shame episode, I think.
Yes, correct. Yep, that's right. Yeah, you know, that's film noir-y, I would say, in the same kind of universe, but I don't think it had voiceover. I just couldn't remember off the top of my
head.
Would
Casablanca be considered a film noir?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
I mean, it's so hard because, like, for ages, it was only black and white movies, and there were lots of detective stories, and they wore trench coats, and they sort of had that affect where they're talking like this. Do you know what I mean? Like,
that's just Bogart right there.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's I think we can, I don't know the world well enough to know the difference. I mean, it would be like if someone was like, is this pop punk or emo? Is this emo? Is this
splitting hairs there a little? Yeah.
I'm sure there were much more nuanced genres back I would have been aware of. But it feels noirish.
Fair enough. It feels Bogart-ish to me. And Bogart-ish seems like the Bogart noir Venn diagram seems like it's almost one circle.
Yeah.
It's Bogartian.
Yeah. Ooh. It's much more like Sunny Day Real Estate emo than like Promise Ring emo. If you will.
And I will. Oh, man. Mark's going to be killing himself when he hears this episode. He's going to be so mad he missed it.
Before we move on from this point, can we just talk about how fracking cool it is to light a cigar or fingernail?
Yeah.
Have any of you ever done that?
No, I gotta try.
Are those prop matches? Like,
I gotta try.
I've never tried it.
If anyone listening to this has ever done it, please let us know.
Not a lot of people know that people in the 40s and 50s all had like flint fingernails. who sort of evolved out of it. But back then it was very common. It was an affliction. Normally it was quite rough. But for that one instance, it was actually quite very helpful.
Vitamin C took care of that.
Yes. Turns out they didn't drink any milk for centuries.
I see you got the flint nail again. Here, have some milk.
Now, listen here. See, I like my flint nail. I'm going to stick with it. So one more thing before we move on to kind of the newer age of film noir. I would be very curious. So, you know, we in doing a remake here, we've talked a lot about like, what does that look like? Do you do shot for shot, et cetera, et cetera? I think it would be very interesting to try to basically use the exact same dialogue, but take all of the baby, sweetheart, toots, whatever, like all of the terrible, awful misogyny, like take those words out and just leave the guts of the story. And I think that could be, you could do that and just film it as is with that script. And I think it could be pretty successful today. Again, maybe voiceover aside. But I think that, you know, I feel like the guts of the script is pretty solid. And I think taking away some of that, I think would maybe take away a bit of the personality that film noir brought, but it would also make it, you know, reasonable for a film today. So that would be my proposal.
I would agree because, again, I think that the story is really interesting. And I think it has a lot of, you know, I was going to say, I think it's got a lot of potential. This movie could really be something. but I think that if you took away all that stuff, it would lead to a much different, darker drama. But I think I would watch it. I don't know.
Yeah, I might keep true detective-y. Yeah,
I might throw a few babies or whatever into Meryl Streep's dialogue just because.
Sure.
That brings up an interesting question, though, and I don't think that I think in our earlier days of this podcast, we did this a little bit more than recent history, but when each of us was recasting, I think we were all recasting a very different feeling movie. I know Andy has mentioned that his was not going to be very film noir-y at all, and his casting choices sort of reflected that. Mine was going to be very film noir, in fact, even set in the 1940s. Kyle and Lee, did you have a vision for what this movie would look like or feel like with your casting choices and with your remake?
Lee, I'll let you go first.
Mine wasn't necessarily going to be set in the 40s, but it was going to be sort of a modern day film noir, just in the way it was shot, I guess.
Yeah. I seriously came up with so many different freaking versions of this movie. Like, I thought about doing an all British version because I felt like that dialogue in the King's English or the Queen's English or whatever it is would somehow smooth that out a little bit and somehow like be okay. Maybe not like all the babies and tootsies or whatever, but like, I strongly considered that, you know, having it be modern, but in England, but having that same vibe. I just thought of so many different versions. So I think I would probably land about what Lee said, where it would have that vibe, but not necessarily in the 40s. But I seriously thought of like so many different versions of this. So I don't have a definitive what mine looked like.
Nice.
Yeah. So let's fast forward a little bit and talk about modern film noir. So I think that we can see the roots of film noir in a lot of things, right? Tarantino, Fargo, you know, Coen Brothers, that kind of vibe. But the genre as it's seen here is not really around still. So let's talk a little bit about kind of what that look and feel is like today. So we listed off a bunch of movies. Lee, you did a few here, and we've kind of peppered them throughout here. Why don't you say a little bit about kind of what you had thought about that is still here in movies that came to your mind, and then we'll each just kind of chime in. Maybe we'll just go alphabetically about other movies that we saw and kind of wrote down here.
Some of the modern day movies that I think have that sort of film noir vibe, just either, you know, the dark subject matter or the way it's shot, the way the lighting is. I was thinking of movies like Clute, which took place in the 70s, Malice, which I think I've mentioned before on this podcast, was released in 1993, To Die For. That's a Gus Van Sant movie.
Mm-hmm.
Road to Perdition, and Gone Girl is probably the most recent one that I can think of right offhand. But those movies all, in my opinion, are very much in the same sort of spirit of the genre, especially Malice. I mean, just when I think about that movie, most of the scenes in that are very dark. Especially the scenes where there's some sort of really strong emotional component or it's an emotional scene. Those scenes are particularly dark.
And you mean dark in terms of lighting, not just in terms of tone, right?
Correct.
Got it.
Yes. Same with To Die For and Gone Girl. And that's very much a film noir thing. I threw in there L.A. Confidential. That's kind of, it's more of a, I guess, a police story.
Yeah.
It's got some roots though.
Yep.
Yeah. It has some aspects of it.
I think there's often a blending of like gangster films, film noir, cop films. Like I think those have the Venn diagram of all of those. There's a lot of overlap in those in terms of like the common elements and stuff. So I feel like it can borrow from all three of those and still have that kind of feel.
Definitely. Who put Sin City in there? That's a pretty good call.
I put that one in there. Yeah, that one. It's very much a graphic novel movie, but in terms of the way that it is filmed and shown, it is not even a grayscale comic. It is a black and white comic, and it is basically a black and white movie, if you will. I mean, it is pretty darn close. There's not a lot of gray. It's really high contrast in that regard, so that kind of lends it to that vibe of that. And they speak in kind of that street style, like I could tell from when she walked in the room that she would be troubled, kind of vibe, you know, that kind of thing, you know, written on purpose that way. But it's a very modern film in terms of the violence and the tone and just the sort of depravity of it, if you will. But yeah, I think that's kind of a blend of modern sensibilities with film noir style.
Also narration.
Yeah. Good call. Mm-hmm. Lots of it, actually. Yeah. I also put in Mulholland Drive, which is about as twisted a film noir as you can find. I mean, that is, you know, David Lynch can get a hold of anything and make it his own weird sort of offshoot of the genre. But that is an incredible movie if you haven't seen it, but very noir-y in kind of the root of it, especially being in kind of L.A. Hollywood vibe. I feel like a lot of those movies were in and around L.A. and Hollywood, even if you never saw the beach, you felt the kind of vibe of that scene. So I thought that was a good one as well.
And I don't know who put it in, but we, I think, have all referenced it in some form or fashion, but we definitely need to mention and talk about Brick, which is a movie that came out 7-8 years ago now, maybe, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And it's a Rian Johnson murder mystery movie that is very much modern day noir in every aspect.
Yeah, it's not black and white. It was actually 2005, crazily enough. That was like a long time ago. It was so it is basically a high school drug mystery film that happens to have dialogue that is 100% film noir. Like, there is, if you were to mute it and just see the closed captioning of it, you'd be like, is this the right closed captions? Like, it's kind of matching what they say in the mouth, but it doesn't make sense. So it is a really interesting sort of juxtaposition between the two, a really balance between the two. But it is, yeah, full on film noir. So it is most definitely in that kind of modernized version of that. It's a pretty incredible movie. It's not super easy to like. I think it's kind of odd that way, and the same kind of thing where, like, it takes a little bit. It doesn't, at the beginning, you know, there's no title card that says this movie is for all the film noir fans or whatever, right? Like, it's just, you get into it. It would be as though if they didn't call Romeo and Juliet Romeo and Juliet, and they just sort of spoke in Shakespearean iambic pentameter, at first you'd be like, something's weird, something's different. They don't pay a lot of it, or don't focus a lot of attention on it, but then throughout you're kind of like, okay, I can feel it, and it's really, really compelling because of that.
Yeah, that was one of those movies that when I didn't know much about it when I first started watching it on Netflix, and it, the whole first 20 minutes of it, it's, there's so much cognitive dissonance with the dialogue versus what is happening on screen that, yeah, it's just like a, what am I, but where? And then all of a sudden it's just like, oh, and then you kind of fall into it, and it was just gravy after that. And again, Andy's going to hate it because it's film noir.
Yeah.
But it is that film noir in dialogue, maybe not in how it's shot, but in dialogue, that is exactly what they are trying to do.
Yeah. So finally, before we wrap up here, let's talk a little bit about the casting and the performances of the original movie. Jerry, you had some notes here about how, kind of, again, speaking of cognitive dissonance, the sort of comparison of Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck in this movie versus other movies, and how strange that was. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that in looking at it, and I guess in researching, this point may be a little bit moot, but one of the things that I enjoyed about it is that both Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray, when they were cast in this movie, were not typecast into these roles. They were very much not these roles in the movies prior to this. She was not a femme fatale. He was not a, you know, fast-talking sort of gumshoe. I guess he wasn't a detective in this movie, but, you know, that sort of smooth-talking, creepy guy. And so I appreciate that they go against type in this movie in such a strong way, and it really works for both, in my opinion, for both the characters and the movie itself. And I was reading a few interviews and things in leading up to the podcast, and Fred McMurray, actually, when they approached him to be in the movie, he was like, "Are you sure?" because it was so against grain with what he had been used to doing and sort of the characters that he plays. And even past this, he went in to play, you know, the absent-minded professor and the dad from My Three Sons, and the shaggy dog, even, mm-hmm. like, just some really silly, goofy Disney type characters. And then there's this, which is about as hard nosed as you can get, being kind of this sleazy insurance salesman who decides to, you know, commit murder to get some money.
Yeah, I agree. And, I think if we were to look at the Edward G. Robinson, I feel like he was like a gangster movie guy. Like, he was most often kind of the the guy in Home Alone, like, you know, the
made-up film noir movie.
Keep the change, you filthy animal.
Angels with Dirty Faces, or Angels with whatever it was. Yeah.
Filthy Souls.
Filthy Souls, that's it, yeah. So he was, like, I think most often kind of like a gangster in gangster movies. So I think it was interesting that he was kind of more of a straight person in this one than anything. I thought that was kind of cool. But yeah, I agree completely that when you think of the lineage of Fred McMurray, especially, like, the Nutty Professor and this role, like, it just doesn't make any sense. It's very odd. But
if Edward G. Robinson did not play Al Capone in a movie, he certainly should have.
Yeah. No, I mean, I feel like that was a given. Here, let's look here. Oh, no, it doesn't look like it. Not by name. But yeah, he was in tons and tons of gangster movies back in the 30s and 40s. I feel like that, like this movie was kind of on the tail end of that style. That was mostly in the 30s. All right. Anything else on the performances you guys can think of? Anything, any other of the sort of tail end or side actors, the minor characters, if you will?
I really enjoy it that basically, like you said at the very beginning of our previous episode, we recast the entire movie.
Yeah.
This movie only had like 8 or 9 actors in the entire thing. And I appreciate that about just how tightly woven this story is and how there really wasn't any wasted space at all.
Yeah, agreed. All right, so I think that wraps up the second part and our whole discussion of Double Indemnity. Thanks so much, gents. Our next episode will be coming out in a couple weeks after this one, where we'll be doing our 50th episode celebration with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, so stick around for that. In the meantime, Remaker's Mark is a proud member of the Math is Hard Network. To find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast on the network, check us out at mathishard.net. There you will find show notes with links to all of the people, movies, and links discussed in this episode. This information is also attached to the show file in the podcast client of your choice. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts, including iTunes and Google Play, where you can rate and review me, Remaker's Mark, which would mean the world to us. I almost said like Meme Maker's Mark. That's an interesting idea. Remaker's Mark is this podcast. We are on both Facebook, search for Math is Hard Net or Remaker's Mark, Twitter at Remaker's Mark, or Instagram at Remaker's Mark Podcast. So please join in the discussion there as well. So thank you, gentlemen. This was a good time. Until the next time, may the force be with you.
And also with you.